This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last year, Sir Ralph Fiennes and Mike Stroud became the first people to cross Antarctica on foot without the help of other men, animals, or machines. Fiennes and Stroud walked 1,340 miles, each man pulling a sled weighed down with nearly 500 pounds of supplies. The temperature dropped down to minus 86 degrees Fahrenheit. The men had gangrene, hypothermia, stomach disorders, and were starving. Why did these men do it? Fiennes is a celebrated explorer. My guest Mike Stroud is a doctor who studies the impact of extremes on the human body. He's a survival consultant to the British Ministry of Defense. He had served as the base doctor for a previous Antarctica expedition. In 1986, he and Fiennes attempted the first unassisted journey on foot to the North Pole. Now Stroud has written a new book about crossing Antarctica with Ralph Fiennes called Shadows on the Wasteland. Stroud told me they took remarkably little clothing on that trip across Antarctica.
We basically followed a policy that if you're working hard, which we would be pulling our sledges all the time, you get very hot very easily. So we were just wearing long underwear, a sort of fleece-type clothing, and a thin cotton outer jacket. That was all we had. It's less than perhaps many trekkers or backpackers would wear just going out in the hills in the fall, perhaps in the States, and certainly less than they would wear in the winter. We did have good gloves and good boots and twin layers of socks and three pairs of undergloves and things like that. Hands and feet were a problem to protect, and we covered our faces completely as well because they got frostbitten very easily.
And what would you do at night? You said, you know, when you're pulling a sled, you keep warm, but at night you're not doing any work. So what would you sleep in and how would you keep warm?
Well, at night, we obviously put up a tent, and we did have very good sleeping bags. Although, surprisingly, the tent could get quite warm, because, of course, the sun was up all the time, day and night, because it was the Antarctic summer. And so with the sun shining on the tent, if it was a clear night and a still night, so that the wind wasn't blowing, the tent would get warm enough. Well, it would actually get warm to hot. When it was cloudy, however, or the wind was blowing hard, then it was cold. And our bags were big, down-filled bags, specially waterproofed on the inside so they couldn't get any of the sweat from our bodies and let it get into the down and slowly degrade the down, because we had no way of washing or cleaning or repairing anything that we had with us.
Tell us a little bit about the texture of snow in Antarctica, the snow that you had to walk through and pull a sled across.
Well, people are very surprised about the snow in very cold places because it's not as slippery as you might expect. The slipperiness of snow really depends on the pressure from your ski or the sledge runner melting it a bit by the squeezing of it. And then you get a bit of water and ice together and that makes it slippery. When it gets very cold, perhaps 40, 50 below, you start finding that the snow doesn't melt at all and it becomes more like sand. And so it's more like pulling a sledge across the beach or something like that, rather than across a snowfield.
So you had to work really hard to pull that sled.
Oh, yeah, it was very hard work and very continuous work for many, many hours every day.
How often did it snow?
It snowed very rarely. The Antarctic is a very dry place. It's so cold that you don't really get much precipitation. And the Antarctic is really a desert by any standards in terms of how much actually falls out of the sky. It's very, very little every year. A lot of snow blows from place to place, but it doesn't come down again.
How long do you think your footprints lasted in the snow?
Oh, not long. The Antarctic is by far the windiest place on Earth. And strong winds of 100 miles an hour blow frequently, and they blow your footprints to dust just before, just immediately after you make them.
Now, I want you to compare for us your age and your weight and height and all of that with Ranulph Fiennes, who you traveled with.
Ran and I were very different men. He's a very big individual. He's in England, we'd say 6'4". I think perhaps you use inches in the States. He's fairly heavily built, and he was about 48 years old when we did the trip. I'm 10 years younger than that, and a small man by any standards. I'd only be 5'6". I'm a small man, whilst he's large, and I was younger. Ran was a born athlete. He really could have been an international standard athlete when he was younger. whilst I would never claim to be so fit and strong. But for the first time on this trip, he actually felt his age a bit. And whereas on past journeys we've made together, I've had a real struggle keeping up with him, on this occasion he found the trip harder than I. And he found that mentally difficult to take because it was new for him.
So he was bigger than you are, more athletically inclined, but you were younger than he is. So what kind of debates did that lead to about how to divide up the food?
We often talked about how we should divide up the sledge loads and eventually decided that we should have equal sledge loads when we started. Ran did wonder whether, being a bigger man, he should eat more than I. But there again, I felt that if he wanted to eat more, then he should actually carry more on his sledge and have a heavier sledge. So we set off with the same loads. But as the journey progressed, once we were 2 or 3 weeks into it, it was becoming evident that I was finding it a bit easier than him. And obviously, we wanted to get across as fast as we could. And he eventually agreed to let me have some of the additional weight on his sledge, just a small amount, to try and equalise our speeds. And for much of the journey, I took very slightly more than him. But it was pretty equal most of the time.
Who sets the pace in a trip like this? There were times when you wanted to travel faster. There were times when he traveled faster and you had a broken ankle. And it sounded like this was a cause of a lot of friction between the two of you.
Yes, inevitably, when you're traveling together, you don't always feel like moving at exactly the same speed. Sometimes when I was in front and got some distance ahead, Ran used to curse me for it and get a bit upset. But there wasn't very much I could do about it. Your body sort of dictates the speed that you want to go, and that's the speed you go. So we made some adjustments in the sledge weights to try and account for that. Later in the journey, I had a very bad ankle. I'd fallen on it. In fact, I'd fractured it, although not too badly, but it was swollen and hurt. And then he found himself racing off ahead, and I looked at him disappearing into the distance when it was his turn leading, and got pretty upset about that as well. You do... It hurts the morale when you get left behind, and we both had turns at getting left behind.
Did you ever lose each other?
No, we were very careful not to get so far apart that we could lose each other. And when the weather was bad, and certainly some of the time, the weather would close right down with strong gale force winds and no visibility at all, really. And in those conditions, we stuck incredibly close together because if one of us had lost the other, it could have been fatal.
What were the worst medical problems you experienced during the journey?
Well, the medical problems were pretty varied, really. In some ways, the worst were just the sort of chronic ones that went on and on, the soreness that you got from the rubbing of the harness that you pulled the sledge with and the pain in your back from pulling the sledge. But we had some real acute ones as well. Ran had a terrible frostbitten foot quite early in the trip that didn't get any better and caused him terrible pain. And later he got other toes frostbitten and he had problems there. I had frostbitten fingers, which were pretty uncomfortable and made doing anything with your hands very, very painful. And I also fractured my ankle, as I mentioned.
Now, you had frostbite on your fingers, and the frostbite was so bad it took the skin off your fingers?
Yes, that's right. First, your fingers go black and swollen with blisters. And then, if it's not so deep that the whole finger is dying, which in my case it wasn't, all the dead parts of the skin all peel off like gloves coming off, and they leave a raw and terribly, terribly tender finger inside. And I ended up with 9 out of 10 of my fingers like this, sort of pink like raw meat. And they were exquisitely painful when you touch things. It was really nasty.
So that must have been fairly crippling. I mean, you need your fingers to do things.
Yes, although you don't need your fingers that much during the day in a place like Antarctica, where you just trudge along for a lot of the time. But it was awful in the tent in the evening, trying to cook, trying to dress and undress. That sort of thing was very difficult. It's amazing how hard you have to pull on a pair of socks. You don't realise it until when your fingers are hurting, you try and pull on pairs of socks and that sort of thing, getting boots on and off cooking.
Mike Stroud is my guest. His new book about crossing Antarctica is called Shadows on the Wasteland. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest Mike Stroud is a doctor and survival consultant. Last year, he crossed Antarctica on foot. Now, you conducted medical tests on both you and Rand Fines, who you were traveling with. What kind of tests did you do, and what was the purpose of the tests?
Well, the medical tests we were doing were looking at what extremes would happen to us, and they were also looking at how exercise would affect our body weight and our body composition and things like that. So we weighed ourselves before and during the trip. We measured how much fat and how much muscle we had. We took blood tests every 10 days to see what was happening to our cholesterol and other fats in the blood and the sugar levels in the blood and this sort of thing. And we measured our metabolism. That's how quickly your body ticks over and burns fuel before and after the trip. It was interesting from the point of view of survival and knowledge about what extremes you could go to, but also interesting from the point of view of what it taught us about the normal. For example, we would be losing weight through exercising a great deal whilst eating a great deal. We were actually eating twice as much as a normal person might eat. And so the way that we lost weight would be an interesting comparison to the way that people try and lose weight through dieting when they feel that they're overweight, because the influence of how much you restrict your food and how much exercise you do is not fully understood. And so we could provide some information about that.
So what did you learn?
Well, what we learned was that, for a start, exercise alone can definitely make you lose weight. I mean, we lost about 50, 60 pounds in weight through exercise alone, whilst eating twice as much as normal. And with that weight loss, instead of our metabolism getting depressed, going lower, which is what happens if you lose weight through dieting, and it's one of the reasons why dieting to lose weight, you pretty soon stop losing weight, and when you stop going on the diet, you put it all back on again. With the exercise, we found that we'd lost a lot of weight and our metabolism had actually gone up. This is the way our bodies were ticking over, even at rest, sitting still. So it sort of confirmed some of the ideas about exercise and losing weight, and it confirmed them in a very spectacular way.
Now, the blood and urine samples that you took, did you have to carry those with you for the whole trip?
Yes, we collected blood and urine samples during the journey. We took blood every 10 days and small urine samples every night. And, of course, we could just let them freeze by just putting them on the sledge and they'd be frozen and preserved for when we got back. So we got some interesting changes, in particular, perhaps, the fact that our blood fats, our cholesterol levels, didn't go up despite our eating four times as much saturated fat as anyone would recommend for health. We were eating a very high-fat diet because it didn't weigh so much if we took our food in the form of fat. And it didn't upset our cholesterol levels. In fact, the good sort of cholesterol went up and the bad sort went down, sort of, again, confirming that exercise can offset a pretty nasty diet, well, in fact, a very nasty diet. And we found that when we did measurements of our energy expenditure and that sort of thing on the urine, that we got fantastically high levels that had never been recorded. It was some interesting findings. At times we had levels of work which were twice as high, for example, as the cycle riders in the Tour de France, which is meant to be one of the biggest endurance events in the world. We got tremendously high levels of work every day because we did so many hours every day.
What were you eating?
We ate a diet that consisted of porridge in the morning, which had butter melted into it, because the butter added fat and the fat added a lot of calories. We stopped a couple of times in the day for soup, which we melted butter into as well. And when we got to the tent, we got inside and had a cup of tea and what's called a flapjack biscuit, a very fatty biscuit with some butter on it as well, and then a freeze-dried meal with some butter in it and a hot chocolate drink with some butter in it. So all in all, we ate an awful lot of butter and a very high-fat diet.
Now, you lost a lot of protein and weight in your muscles, right?
Yes, we did. Our weight losses weren't just fat. Chiefly because we burned up nearly all the fat that was in our bodies. And so we were turning to our muscles as well to burn those up. And about half of the weight we lost was muscle burnt up as well. And in fact, we took pieces of muscle before and after the trip by using a sort of enormous needle into the muscle of our thigh. And those were looked at under the microscope. And when we got back, the muscles weren't only smaller, but the enzymes in the muscles, which are the things that make them work, had gone right down. In fact, their activity had gone down by 70% in the samples we took.
Now, so something else about your health during this trip. When you got back to England afterwards, you were having eye problems. You were having, trouble focusing on things, I think.
Yes, that's right. When we got back to civilization as such, we found that we couldn't see very well and couldn't really focus beyond things which were just perhaps an arm's length away. And we didn't know what that was, and we were examined by a specialist. And it was found that our eyes had gone, had lost the ability to focus out beyond a short distance because we'd spent so much time looking at nothing. It's actually a problem that had been recognised in the past in airline pilots and problems of near misses in aircraft, because a pilot looking out through the windscreen at nothing will slowly come into focus. So his eyes are actually in focus just in front of his face. And then he won't see the other aircraft approaching. We'd been looking at nothing for so long that we'd got used to this position, and we'd lost the strength required in the muscles to focus the lens of our eyes and see further.
When you say looking at nothing, do you mean you're looking at this vast sameness of snow and horizon?
Yes, that's right. For much of the day, you spent your time looking at white, and it was featureless. And so your eyes got used to seeing nothing and didn't get used to focusing and moving around and changing the focus of your eyes, so we lost the ability to do so properly.
Now, how long did it take for your fingers, which were frostbitten, to heal?
My fingers took about 2 months, 3 months, something like that, to heal up completely. But they did get effectively completely better, although they will continue to be vulnerable to the cold in the future. Rand's toes weren't so lucky. He's lost a couple of toes from his frostbite, which was really quite bad. And his foot and other areas of frostbite did take more like 8 or 9 months to heal up.
One of your purposes in your expedition across Antarctica was to study the physical effects on the body. I'm interested also in the psychological impact of spending several months just walking across this vast snowy plain. What does that do to your mind? I know you had company, you were traveling with somebody, but you weren't always getting along because the pressures on you were so great. So did what kind of mood swings did you go through?
I found that I had terrible mood swings. A lot of the time it was just terribly difficult to keep going. And of course, although I'd done this sort of thing before, you tend after these sorts of trips to remember the good times and not really remember what it was like until the very first day of a new trip, like when we set off across Antarctica. You suddenly realise how awful it's going to be just mentally to keep going, and that makes it hard. Nevertheless, at the beginning of the trip, for the first month or so, we seemed to be making reasonable progress, and I spent a lot of time thinking about home and all the things I'd do when I got back and being pretty positive about life. And so things passed fairly easily in daydreams a lot of the time. But then you felt that you'd really thought every thought you possibly could have several times. And in the second month of the expedition, I began to get completely obsessed almost about whether or not we could get this journey done. And it seemed less and less likely that we could complete it. And I felt more and more negative, and spent most of the time actually thinking about how I could get out of it, thinking of ways I could perhaps feign an illness to get out of it and that sort of thing. So I would spend my whole day imagining what illness I would pretend to have in order that I'd have to be evacuated. But at the same time, you know that if you do give up, that you've got to live with that, and you've committed yourself to trying this, and you'll feel bad about it afterwards, so you press on. In the last part of the expedition, perhaps the third month and beyond, a lot of the time you weren't thinking very clearly. You were back into a sort of daydream, but it was because we were getting pretty ill with it.
Now, when did you decide, okay, the journey's over, we set out what we accomplished, we can go home now?
Well, at the very end of the journey, we wanted to cross the last ice shelf. What Antarctica has is on its edges great big sheets of floating glacier, which are on the sea. They're not actually part of the continent, but they're sort of traditionally part of the challenge. And what we'd done was set out from the Atlantic coast of one ice shelf, cross the ice shelf, cross the continent, and come down onto the ice shelf that would lead to the open Pacific. And we wanted to cross that too, but we were only about 60, 70 miles into that when we realised things were getting so bad that we weren't going to be able to complete the last couple of hundred miles of our journey. I mean, we had gone 1,400 miles, the longest ever, but we were going to run out of food before we could complete that last ice shelf. And if we didn't, we were going to take such risks with our lives that it was beginning to be unreasonable.
So what do you do when it's time to go back? You have a satellite phone?
Well, we carried a radio and we could get through to our base, which was now on the far side of the Antarctic, where mm-hmm. where we'd left from. And once we decided that we were going to give up, then an aircraft came out, our own aircraft that we'd chartered to pick us up. And the plane came quite quickly, actually, which was nice because we were always aware that we were asking a small plane to come and get us across a very large continent, and it might take several weeks before it could actually fly, depending on the weather. But in fact, it came quite promptly, and the journey was over.
Would you do an expedition like this again? Do you think there's another one in your future?
I said to myself on this expedition, I said it every day, I must remember this. I must never, ever do anything like it again. In fact, I even wrote it in my diary to be sure that I couldn't forget. But although I know I said that, I can't remember what it felt like to believe that. And I got a lot of satisfaction from this trip, and I would very much like to do another polar trip again. And I hope that I will do another big trip before I'm too old for it.
Well, Mike Stroud, I'm glad you returned home safely. I thank you very much for talking with us about your journey.
Thank you.
Mike Stroud's new book is called Shadows on the Wasteland. I'm Terry Grosin. This is Fresh Air.